Welcome back to another episode of Out of the Blank Podcast. Walt, it is a pleasure to have you on the show. Would you mind introducing yourself to everyone out there listening?
Yes, my name's Walt Karniski. I'm a developmental pediatrician. Have been practicing for about 35 years and have been very involved with children with ADHD and the medical treatment and management of ADHD.
Now, how'd you get interested in ADHD? Because when I was a kid, it was not talked about. People either considered it didn't exist, or they pushed you and said it was something else, or they just kind of tossed it off to the side. But I've noticed in the past at least 8 years, it has grown in understanding and research.
That's true. The incidence of ADHD has increased, but people in the field recognize that what that increase has been doing is getting closer and closer to the truth. So ADHD is a frequent diagnosis, but it is a frequent diagnosis because it occurs frequently.
But what about how you got interested in looking into ADHD?
I initially did a fellowship in developmental pediatrics at Children's Hospital in Boston, affiliated with Harvard Medical School. And in doing the developmental pediatrics rotation, I became interested in the children with ADHD, primarily because the response to medication was so strong and so high that I really felt that I was accomplishing something with these children, that they had previously not received any treatment, or they had received in-class educational treatment, but no specific medical treatment. And when the medical treatment started, it was just mind-opening to me. It was the response to the children and the changes in their lives was dramatic.
Now, before we get into the medication side of things, I wanted to ask if you could maybe describe what ADHD is and how it's evolved maybe over the past couple of years to a better understanding of it.
ADHD is a collection of symptoms, and we assume because they always occur together that they're related, but we don't really know that. We do know that there is a physical neurologic cause to ADHD, despite the fact that it is difficult to clearly recognize the collection of symptoms. So in other words, if I see a child with short attention span, hyperactivity, difficulty concentrating, easy distractibility, that could be caused by ADHD, but it could also be caused by anxiety, or it could also be caused by autism, or it could be caused by other factors. So I think the first thing that has to happen when I see a child is I have to first understand what the concerns of the parents are. Then I have to understand what symptoms the child is exhibiting on a regular basis. And then third, I have to put those together to form a diagnosis. Sometimes the diagnosis is correct. Most of the time it is, and sometimes it's not. And the medication that we use actually helps us make that determination. A child with ADHD will show a sudden and dramatic positive response to medication, whereas a child with anxiety disorder will get worse or become more anxious on the same medications used for ADHD. So in some ways, the medication acts as a diagnostic tool as well, which we don't really have. A response to medication tells us that the child probably has ADHD, but not vice versa. So in other words, not having the symptoms of ADHD is going to make it highly likely that that child does not have that diagnosis.
I wanted to ask about, does that differ when it comes to if you're looking at an ADHD child or a child that might have ADHD from boys to girls? Because I know girls show it in different forms or different manners. And I think with kids, especially for me, it was hyperactivity. So that would even be hard to diagnose within a child. Are they just being a kid that's a kid? But I think mine was so extraordinary that it was pretty obvious that there was something else going wrong.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, in terms of the boy girl ratio, when I first started doing this 35 years ago, the ratio in the research literature was considered about 10 to 1, 10 boys for every one girl with ADHD. About 10 years ago, I was doing some research for a presentation, and I was looking at some of the new research. And this new research was indicating that the ratio was closer to 5 to 1. When I started writing the book, I again reviewed the literature and the research, and the ratio was now 3 to 1. And I suspect that in truth, the ratio is 1 to 1. It's just that ADHD presents differently in girls than it does in boys, for the most part. Most boys are hyperactive, impulsive, short attention span, and distractibility, whereas the girls tend to be more spacey. The teachers will sometimes say that Susan is not paying attention, but she's not hyperactive or not impulsive. So the girls tend to lack the hyperactivity and the impulsivity, but still have difficulty focusing and concentrating. As a result, they get diagnosed less frequently. And I think that's an error. I think, as I said, the ratio is probably closer to 1 to 1. It's just that it presents differently in girls than it does in boys.
Kind of like the boys can show up in the classroom, their ADHD symptoms, but the girls might show theirs on the playground or something.
More more in social situations than in academic situations. I remember seeing some girls that were 17, and they were bright, doing well in school, and that doesn't fit with ADHD, but it seems that they were able to compensate for their ADHD up until to a point. And when they got to be 13 or 14, and the workload became harder and higher, then their ADHD symptoms became more obvious.
Now, what about the introduction of medication when it comes to like the start of when we started being able to find a way to medicate ADHD, especially with children? And then maybe we can get to somehow the standards today or what the qualifications are for today.
I'm not exactly sure what the question is there.
The introduction of medication for kids with children with ADHD.
Okay. You mean introducing it to them or to the parents?
Introducing it to them or the parents. I mean, the parents have the overall say, but what drugs were being used first? How is it being kind of brought to them?
Well, usually the first thing I have to talk about with parents is the diagnosis. And I frequently am confronted with parents who will say, but isn't ADHD overdiagnosed? And so that's usually the first thing that I have to deal with. How confident am I in the diagnosis? And how confident am I that medication will be or is the recommended treatment? So I think that really is the first question that I have to address. And usually the way I address that is there are three ways that I'm convinced that ADHD medication makes a dramatic difference. The first way is by looking at the immediate response. The medications used to treat ADHD are such that they cause their impact and their primary effect within hours after the first dose. So it generally is pretty easy to see a response to medication. Unlike taking an antibiotic for an infection, you sometimes have to wait 5 to 6 days to see if the antibiotic is going to improve the symptoms. ADHD responds usually within 30 to 40 minutes. And by 2 hours is at its maximum effect.
Even with some drugs like Lexapro and other antidepressants that people take, they usually say that you have to take it for about 1.5 to 2 weeks before you start seeing some effects from it.
Exactly. But it's unlike those medications. Yeah, there's no need to build up an effect, the effects are immediate. So that's the first thing I discuss with parents. The second thing I discuss in order to indicate that the effectiveness is that what happens to people with ADHD who are not treated. And the research on this is extensive and highly consistent and convincing. And what the research shows is that in many areas of adult life, ADHD has an impact, even when people don't realize that it's the ADHD. And what I mean by that is that adults with ADHD who were not treated with medication have a higher incidence of car accidents. They're more likely to have had driver's license suspended. They're more likely to have higher debt. They're more likely to have a substance abuse problem with some other medication. They're more likely to have social relation difficulties. They're more likely to have lost a job. And the list goes on and on and on. If you in my book, there's about four pages which indicate what are the behaviors that frequently occur in adults who have ADHD who are not treated. Now, when I go through this list with parents, it's pretty concerning at times, sometimes depressing, if the parents say, well, all of these things are going to happen to my child. And I say, no, these are just higher risk. But the interesting thing or the fascinating thing about this is that those adults who have ADHD, who were treated with medication, don't have a higher incidence of those problems. So if they were treated with medication as children, their adult life, even if they're not on medication as adults, their adult life is significantly improved compared to children who have ADHD and are not on medication.
Well, why would you say there's such a stigma behind the ADHD medication? I always thought of it kind of as like glasses. Either you need them or you don't. You can take them, like especially something that's immediate like ADHD medication, or as immediate as like an hour or two. It's something where it's like, okay, if you take it, then you don't have to take it tomorrow and you'll be exactly how you were before. It's not something that, like, you know, you have to keep taking it for weeks and weeks and the effects have to wean off for weeks and weeks and weeks. No, this is something that you can take it this day or not take it. But why do you think there's such a stigma behind the medication? Was that from the earlier usages of like Ritalin and things of that sort that were being prescribed compared to what we have now?
I think it's partially due to the fact that initially when we were prescribing these medications, we didn't prescribe them in the optimum way. We didn't prescribe them and warn the parents about the side effects, because the side effects are all manageable and are not serious. So let me tell you a story. I went to see my dermatologist a couple years ago, and in walked this woman that I had not seen before. And she said that my dermatologist was on vacation, and so she was going to see me that day. So I said, great. And she said, now I understand you're a developmental pediatrician and you see kids with ADHD. She said, what kind of kids do you see? And I see kids with ADHD. And she looked at me and said, oh, ADHD, that's overdiagnosed, isn't it? I'm getting this from the dermatologist now. And so I look at her and I say, well, let me answer that question by asking you a question. How frequent is skin cancer in adults over 65? And she said, oh, it's quite frequent. It occurs about 30 to 40% of the time if people don't take, and I said, oh, then skin cancer must be overdiagnosed. And she said, no, it's not overdiagnosed. It just occurs very frequently because people don't take care of their skin. They don't put sunscreen on and so on. And I said, yeah, but it still sounds like it's overdiagnosed, 40%. And she said, oh, I see what you're doing here. And so I was trying to make a comparison between other diagnoses that we make in medicine and ADHD. ADHD is lacking because it doesn't have a blood test or an X-ray test that makes the diagnosis, but that doesn't disqualify the validity of that diagnostic entity.
I just don't think people like the over. I don't believe in there's an overdiagnosis problem. I just think it somehow got hooked into the trend of today's world, where you see a couple tick clips on the internet that tell you might have ADHD if you have these, and these, and they're things like can't sleep very well. Well, most of the world can't sleep very well, and then it's like things like depression. Well, I have depression. It's like, well, that's not just an ADHD thing. It can be. But it's not specific to that. And that's why I always hear my friends go, well, I think I have a little bit of ADHD, or everybody has a little bit of ADHD. I go, no, you don't, though, because if you actually have it, you understand that there's a whole other host of things and not being able to sleep well.
Well, those are very astute comments because I see ADHD not as a disease. I see ADHD not as a neurologic disorder, despite the name disorder in the title. I see it as an evolutionary difference. And Tom Hartman wrote a book called I actually am blanking on the book's name now. At any rate, he wrote a book on ADHD and he talked about the fact that ADHD is up until about 200 years ago, the symptoms of ADHD were actually positive characteristics. Let's go back 100,000 years ago. You're a caveman and your job is to go out every morning and pick berries for the tribe's breakfast. So you're out picking berries, putting them in your leather pouch, getting ready to turn around and go back to the cave. And all of a sudden you hear a rustling in the bushes behind you. What should you do?
I mean, my first instinct is to go check out what it is, which
Exactly.
isn't the
So
smart one.
your first instinct is to be distracted by that sound. Because if you're not distracted by it, and it's a saber-toothed tiger, then you're going to be the saber-toothed tiger's lunch, and you're not going to go back to the cave, you're not going to have children, and you're not going to carry that distractibility gene to the next generation. But instead, if distractibility increases your chance of survival because you turned and looked and saw that it was a saber-toothed tiger, and you pulled your knife or you ran, in both cases, you get back to the cave. You're able to continue your relationship with the other people in the cave. You begin to have children, and that carries the distractibility gene to the next generation. And because they have more distractibility, they're more likely to survive and live to the next generation. Until we come to about 1850 or 1870, when we began passing laws saying that all children were required to go to school. Previously, a lot of children didn't go to school. They would work in their father's blacksmith shop, they would work on the farm, and they would never learn to read. And so, if they had distractibility and difficulty focusing and concentrating, it wouldn't show up as a problem. As a matter of fact, it would show up as a positive characteristic because it keeps them alive. Does that make sense?
No, I mean, I really appreciate that perspective because I think most people with ADHD have gone their whole life thinking they should be ashamed of having ADHD or not being able to talk about it. But I also think it's because society has kind of pushed past all those old evolutionary traits that you might deem as satisfactory, which I'm all with, I'll tell you that
Right.
much.
But you know, the interesting thing about this is that I realized as a physician seeing these children that I had a couple choices. The first thing I could do is assume that this is a problem and try to get rid of it. And that's why the medication's so appealing. At times, medication isn't the best treatment. Sometimes educational treatments are far better and work better than the medication. So that all has to be taken into account when recommending a treatment for the family. But I think the point here is that I, as a physician, have a choice. I can either treat the child with medication, or if I decide I don't want to use medication, I can invent a time machine, go back in time, and change the way children were educated 100,000 years ago. Of course, that's not obviously a good solution. So instead, we're forced to label the child as having a problem and give medication. And yet, what other choice do I have? This child has to live in this world, in this century, with these requirements. And the requirements in this world require us to be focused, to follow schedules, to if we promise somebody that we're going to do something, we have to follow up on that and do what we said we were going to do. And all of those things lead to success in life and happiness in life. If I get into an argument about whether it's a diagnosis or an evolutionary trait, it doesn't matter because I don't have any other choices right now. I can't send them back in time. I can't change the way children are educated in the whole country, although I did try. We have two schools in Tampa, one of which is the purpose is to educate children specifically with ADHD, learning disorders, and anxiety disorders. That's Tampa Day School, a school that provides those services here in Tampa. But I think the point here is that ADHD is not necessarily a diagnosis, but it is a disability. I mean, it's not a disease diagnosis, but it is a disability because of the mismatch between that child's characteristics and the world that he's living in.
You think a lot of people would understand it more and be less likely to say that they have ADHD without being diagnosed if they actually understood the kind of things that people with ADHD who have had it their whole life and were unmedicated have to go with on a daily basis, like social isolation, a lot of rejection sensitivity, certain little characteristics and little things that end up becoming really big problems in adulthood. I mean, I have more concern for adulthood than I do the children. And I know people go, well, why don't you care about kids? I'm like, because there's a lot of focus on that. But the part where people start understanding with depression issues that arise in adulthood and still happen in childhood, of course. But those guys know how to, or girls know how to get a gun and know how to do certain things that a child necessarily doesn't have the capabilities to go and get on their own, which is why I get nervous. Now, I'm 26 and I recently just signed up to get prescribed a certain drug for ADHD. I'm not going to say it on here because I don't want YouTube to flag me, but there is something where I looked at, I'm 26, my brain develops later, ADHD brains develop later. Why not? If this could make me better and I've had it before, I would like to try it. So I took that chance in understanding. But a lot of parents have concerns is because they don't know what their child is going to be in 20 years when it could be something that could arise later. And I think a lot of that might just be some wrong information from older medications compared to what we have now.
Well, everybody has an opinion about ADHD.
I've tried my best.
Right. Well, the problem is if, you know, my brother is a nephrologist. He specializes in kidney disorders. And when he tells somebody that they have acute glomerulonephritis and they need to take this medication to treat it, most people don't question that. They know that if they don't take the medication, their kidneys are going to fail and they're going to go on dialysis. So they take the medication that's recommended, even without understanding what it's going to do. But with ADHD, it seems that because we don't have that diagnostic tool, because we can't look at an X-ray and say, oh, here's an abnormality on the X-ray, because I can't look at a blood test and say, oh, the blood is abnormal, then people question the diagnosis. And there's many disorders in medicine in which that occurs. Irritable bowel syndrome for a long time was just considered people getting anxious. But we now know it's a true medical disorder because we understand the pathology and we understand the course of action within people with irritable bowel syndrome. So it's no longer overdiagnosed. It's no longer just a problem with anxiety. It's a true medical diagnosis that is enhanced by anxiety.
Can't you just take a cognitive test or show a cognitive test to show that there's a capacity, an issue with working memory, or one of the signs that would be linked to ADHD? My buddy Jeff Copper, who runs an ADHD program and everything, has been on Attitude Magazine, much like yourself has been. He talks about this test that he's understanding and wants to push forward, but a lot of it has to do with societal change of trying to adapt just to give. I mean, you're asking people to, hey, can you go the extra mile for someone that might have a capacity for ADHD? But a cognitive test can show you that someone has some issues in some areas that could be centered to expose ADHD or a clear distinction between someone who's a neurotypical and who's not. But it's not on a test form. It's not like blood tests. It's not something that shows you this gene is out of this or this is out of this. It's kind of just, here's, ask me to count or multiply fractions and not use my hands. And then, not be able to count out loud, we're going to have a problem because I have to do the math in my head and it's going to fade away in at least 2 seconds after you tell me it. So that's a real clear thing where it doesn't show my ignorance as a person. It shows a clear capacity for a symptom of ADHD, which is an issue with working memory. That can be done, but people aren't going to do that. And I think it's because people don't really understand it.
Well, one of the other things that's fascinating about ADHD is that every one of the symptoms that is in the list of symptoms for ADHD, every one of those symptoms can be normal behaviors at certain times in a person's life or in certain situations. So distractibility, as I described before, is a good thing. If you're walking along the street and you're distracted by somebody coming towards you, the situation matters. And so making the diagnosis of ADHD requires us to first look at normal behaviors. Everybody who gets distracted once in a while, everybody has a short attention span when somebody's talking about something that they're not interested in. Everybody forgets things on occasion, but most of the time, those behaviors don't cause us to lose our jobs, to get divorced, to have children born out of wedlock. All of those things occur more frequently because those difficulties are manifest in them more than in somebody else, and as a result, these normal behaviors are then given an abnormal label, and we give them the label of ADHD. To me, it doesn't matter what the actual cause is, even though I can explain to you on a neurologic basis what's happening in the nerve cells of children with ADHD. That doesn't matter to me as much as knowing that this child is so smart, but he's so distracted that he can't display how intelligent he is because of his distractibility and his short attention span.
No, I'm with you on that. How do you look at the side effects? Like, what are the common side effects? What are the common medications that are used today to prescribe to a person with ADHD? I feel like if people actually knew the names and they knew what the side effects were, they would be less concerned. I think a lot of people have probably read things on the internet from older times and realize that the science is a little bit more evolved.
Well, this is I wrote a book about 100 pages about to answer the question that you just asked me. So let me ask you a question first. How many medications do you think there are available and approved by the FDA to treat ADHD?
I would probably either guess it would be a lot less than I think or a lot more than I think. And I'm going to go with the a lot less.
So, what would you guess? Just give me a.
Maybe two or three. At the most, it would be, yeah, I would go with two. Two's a safe bet.
Okay. The number of medications approved by the FDA for the treatment of ADHD is 46
That's still low.
different medications. Now, I say different in quotes because they're not really different. There are two medications that are primarily used to treat ADHD: methylphenidate, which most people know of as Ritalin or Concerta, and amphetamines, which most people know of as Adderall and Vyvanse. But what the drug companies have done is they've recognized that these two medications, amphetamine and methylphenidate, are highly effective for the treatment of ADHD. They're very inexpensive to make. It doesn't cost much to make them. And there's a high demand for it. If you were the CEO of a drug company, wouldn't you want part of that action?
So Big Pharma is making it worse for everybody.
Exactly, Bill. So what they do is they start off with Ritalin, which is a brand name for methylphenidate. The problem with Ritalin is that it only lasts about 3 hours. So you take a dose at 7, and by 11 o'clock, it's worn off, and the children are in school now starting to become hyperactive. And the teacher might send the child to the nurse to get a second dose of medication, but you can see the problems with that. So what the drug companies will do is they come up with a long-acting form of Ritalin called Ritalin SR, then an even longer-acting form called Ritalin XR. But it's really the same medication. It's just lasting longer, which is good for the patient. Don't get me wrong. That's good. But it's also good for the drug company, for the pharmaceutical company. Now, the next company comes in and they realize, oh, there's a short-acting form and there's a long-acting form. But some kids can't take the medication. We'll produce a liquid form of methylphenidate. And they do. And they sell the
liquid. It's called
form.
NyQuil.
No, actually, it's called Clorvance. Because NyQuil would have the opposite effect in a child with ADHD. It'd probably wake them up.
I find caffeine does.
It wakes you up?
Yeah, it gets me going. I don't actually, you know what? I actually sometimes find caffeine can bring me down depending on how much I've had of it.
Yeah, it also depends on whether you have ADHD or not. If you have ADHD and you take caffeine, you'll actually see an improvement in your symptoms. Because caffeine does something similar in the brain to what the stimulant medications do. Not exactly, and caffeine only lasts for about 20 minutes. So you'd have to take a dose of that medication every 20 minutes to cause the same
effect. You'd love my doctor. He made me cut down from 8 to 12 energy drinks a day down to, I think I'm only down to 1 now.
Well, I think it's worth a try. To see what happens, but my feeling is that you'll actually see some improvement, not enough to justify that as the sole treatment, but you'll generally, if you have ADHD, you'll see some improvements on. I one time had a mother bring her 8-year-old child in, and she said, and I started taking the history, and I asked her, when did these symptoms start? And she said, well, he was in preschool and he was hyperactive. But in kindergarten, he started drinking coffee and the symptoms went away.
Kindergarten?
And she was actually furthering this because she was seeing an improvement as well. Now, caffeine only works for about 20 minutes. And then after a few months, it doesn't hardly work at all anymore. But it does introduce people to the medical treatment of ADHD. So let me go back to what I was talking about before, though. So now the drug companies have produced that liquid form. And then comes Adderall. Or first, there was a medication called dexedrine. That's been around since 1960s. And it's been shown to be effective for the treatment of ADHD, just as effective as Ritalin and all the other medications. The benefit of dexedrine is that it came in a long-acting form already, and it was inexpensive. But so what Shire Pharmaceuticals did was they took the dextroamphetamine, the molecule that is in dexedrine, and they combined it with its mirror image, which has no effect at all. But according to the FDA, they've produced a new, different medication. So now they can call it Adderall. But it is exactly the same thing that is in dexedrine that's been around for almost 100 years now.
And let me guess, they upcharge on it too.
Exactly. So they then charge more for that. Then you come along with a medication like Vyvanse. They recognize, actually, before I get to Vyvanse, let me hold back.
I'm about to say, don't tell me the negatives on that. That's what the one drug I'm going to be using.
Okay, well, I'll get into that in just a second. But the problem with the thing to remember about Adderall is that it is exactly the same medication as in dexedrine, but it costs three times as much. It's not available sometimes because of the demand for it. And you could get it by ordering a different medication. You could get the exact same effect at less cost and more availability, but most physicians don't know that. So they continue prescribing Adderall, thinking that it's a new treatment for ADHD, when it's exactly the same thing that has been available for years. Okay, Vyvanse comes along now. And here's what Vyvanse is. So the drug companies recognize that some of these medications in people who don't have ADHD and if taken in high doses can be abused. Okay, so they said, what causes the abuse? Well, what they do is they take the pills, they crush them, they make a powder out of it, and they snort the medication, and they get a little bit of a high from that. It's not much of a high, but they do get a high from that. So the drug company said, maybe we could sell a medication that can't be abused. And parents would appreciate that, of course, and the doctors would as well. So they produce a medication called Vyvanse, which is exactly dextroamphetamine, the same medication that's been around for almost 100 years. And they combine it with an amino acid called lysine. And that amino acid makes the dextroamphetamine ineffective. So if now a person crushes the medication and snorts it, they won't get high from it. But if they swallow it, the medication goes into the stomach. First thing the stomach does is that it breaks off that amino acid, and what's left? Dextroamphetamine.
That's
the
really
same
smart.
Medication that's been around for 100 years.
That's so really smart.
Called, what?
I said that's really smart.
Yeah, and so now it's called Vyvanse, and they can charge 10 times what dextroamphetamine can cost about $10 a month without insurance. Vyvanse can cost about $100 or about $200 a month without insurance. Now, if they're covered by insurance, great. But a lot of times, just to give you a comparison of what the drug companies are doing, they're selling Vyvanse at 10 times the cost. And yes, it costs them a little bit more to make that form that is ineffective when snorted, but effective when swallowed.
Now, do you understand why people
medication?
Do you understand now why people look at alternative methods? I'm not saying you specifically, but this is also why people are really interested in looking at alternative therapies and things that I don't believe in at all. I don't believe in taking certain roots and herbs and things of that sort are going to be able to do the same thing a pill can. But some people can't afford. I have a buddy that can barely afford his Vyvanse medication. It's so expensive. And he's the one that gave me one that I even noticed where I was like, I need to get medicated for at least my ADHD, because I noticed I was different. I didn't feel focused like Adderall. I didn't feel focused like how everyone talks about. I'm super zoned in. I just felt like it's not bad today. You know what I mean? Like I can actually have a conversation without impulsively speaking or having this type of thing, which I thought was important. I'm like, look, I'm 26. If that makes my life better towards, you know, later on, if I could take it and not have a long-term impact on me, I'm like, that's a good thing.
Well, you just said something that not have a long-term impact on me.
Oh, thank God you didn't ask about me taking my buddy's medication.
That's I understand. But let's respond to that statement again. Make that statement again.
Didn't have a long-term impact. I did only take one dose, though. So
okay. Let me explain that one of I said in the beginning that there were three things that I tried to convince parents of the benefits of medication. We've only talked about two of those, the immediate effect and the effect on adult life. There's a third impact that we haven't discussed yet. And that is let's start off with, if you take children with ADHD and you scan their brains, you cannot make a diagnosis of ADHD from that scan. But if you do that in a group of children with ADHD and compare it to the scans of a group of children without ADHD, the first thing that you'll notice is that certain areas of the brain are smaller in the person with ADHD than in the person without ADHD.
The prefrontal cortex, right?
The prefrontal cortex is one of those areas. And the prefrontal cortex, what is the job of the prefrontal cortex?
Like decision-making and
executive function,
yeah,
which means organization, planning, preparing for the future, and so on. And those are things that people with ADHD are not strong on. They tend to be more motivated by the moment and enjoy what's going on at that moment, as opposed to planning for the future. Of course, when the future comes, they're not ready for it. And then they suffer the consequences of it.
Again, that's when you say that's a future Robbie problem. That's something that future Robbie
yeah,
has to do.
But let's go back to the brain issues. So I said that if you have ADHD, there's three areas of the brain that will be smaller in a person with ADHD than a person without ADHD. But the fascinating thing is that if you scan those children as adults, and take the children that were not on medication, that part of the brain, those three parts of the brain, are still smaller in adults as they were in children. But if you take a third group of children, those children with ADHD who took their medication as children, and then you scan their brains as adults, what you'll find is those areas of the brain are no longer smaller. They're now the same size as in people who do not have ADHD. So there's some evidence now, and it's not final, but there's some evidence to support the fact that that the medications are actually producing some long-term benefit that even without medication continues to benefit the person, because that area of the brain is now revitalized in some way that we don't completely understand.
I think you could explain that to a parent, but I still think there's going to be a large amount of hesitation. It's because you don't know what your kid's going to turn out like in 20 years. You know what I mean? Like, if you could know.
And if you wait 20 years, it's too late to do anything about it then.
Is it too late if they can continue to take the medication when they're an adult? The brain maybe won't be fixed because it's not growing anymore when they might decide to take it into later adulthood, but they can still make the choice of getting up every day and taking the medication if they want to take it, right?
That's true.
Yeah. I just look at it like, it's like if you knew your kid was going to be in a car accident the next day, it's like you would do anything to prevent that. I'm only using that example because then you don't know what their life is going to be like in the next 20 years. How is that going to impact them the rest of their life? That's the whole thing for the parent, is like, they came out this way. We don't want them touching alcohol. We don't want them touching this. They might experiment and do whatever, but you hope to God that they get the full chance to be what they're supposed to be without anything hindering their experience through life, even if it's for the good or for the bad.
Okay, so something hindering their life, like
ADHD can hinder their experience through life. Trust me, I've gone through the social isolation. It's part of who I am today, but there is a real thing where I do appreciate that my parents did not put me on it, only for the concept of, is I don't know if it could have done something that changed me from the person. I could have been more successful. That's the gamble, but I took it. And I'm happy with what the results are, but now I'm making the decision as an adult to go explore those options, which I think every person and child should have the opportunity to. There's just a large, I'm just explaining it from the parents' perspective.
I will tell you that I do something that a lot of physicians don't do. And that is that a lot of physicians, when they're talking to parents about their children's behavior, will ask the child to leave the room and go in the waiting room and discuss it with the parents alone. I always included, at least if the child was 7 years of age or older, I always included the child in the history taking with the parent. So in other words, while I was sitting down just letting the parent describe what they were concerned about, I would then, after the mother went through a description, I would then turn to the child and say, John, what do you think of that? And he would say, well, yeah, I agree. Or sometimes he would say, well, it's only because Johnny in front of me is always kicking his feet and I get distracted by that. So at least I give the child the responsibility of giving some of the history and reporting some of the symptoms that he or she is feeling, rather than relying on the parents for everything. I'll ask the child to fill out questionnaires and then discuss those questionnaires with the child as well. So I can't say that the child is making the decision. The parents still have to make the decision for the child, but at least give the child some input. And so what I'll do, for instance, if a child starts saying, especially teenagers, that start saying, I don't need this medication anymore, what I'll really do is trying to figure out why they are saying that, because they recognize the benefit, but they don't feel like they need it anymore. And often it comes down to the side effects. And so we talk about the side effects, and I'll say to them, what side effects would you like to get rid of? And then we talk about those side effects and how to treat them. The side effects from these medications are frequent, but not serious. They're not permanent. Every one of the side effects occur only when you're taking the medication. And when you stop the medication, the side effects disappear.
That's what I think is a big understanding for a lot of parents, is like that's what would let them go at ease a little bit. And it's also the same thing where it's like, if you don't want to take it anymore, just don't take it anymore. You know, then you won't have to, you can choose to take it this day if you want, or you can choose not to. It's up to you, and really in that department. A lot of people with every drug that is out there, like antidepressants, I had a friend that was on three of them, and I told him, maybe you should get medicated for ADHD. I think the reason we get along so well is because you have it and I have it, and I can understand what you're going through and how you're experiencing things. And they switched over to an ADHD medication. They don't take their three antidepressants anymore because their main root cause was the ADHD. I wasn't giving out advice. I was just noticing symptoms, and they went to an actual person to go get that. But I think it's the safety thing of, like, on weekends, if we're hanging out, they don't take it because they don't need to do it around me. But if they got to go to their job that sits behind a desk, they need to take it.
You remember when I said there were 46 medications for treating ADHD? There's one
still
medication.
Pardon?
I said
it's still low, 46. I'm surprised. I was thinking like highballing like 10,000 or something.
Oh, no. Well, we take those 46 medications. There is actually one medication in there that I think is the perfect medication for what you just described, and that's called Daytrana. Have you heard of that medication before? Okay. Most people have not. It is methylphenidate, so the same ingredient that's in Ritalin, exactly the same. But it's in a skin patch, and you apply this patch to your skin. It takes about 30 minutes for the medication to be absorbed and start taking an effect. And here's the magical thing about Daytrana, is that it's the most flexible medication on the market. When you take a medication that's going to last 8 hours and you swallow it, that medication's in you for 8 hours, right? And you can't get it out unless you vomit or go in and surgically remove that pill from your stomach. Okay. But with this medication, all you have to do is, if you don't want to be on it anymore, is you take the patch off, and 20 minutes later, the medication's gone, or mostly gone.
I would be afraid I'd accidentally get like a nicotine patch. Why am I tasting Marlboro right now?
But furthermore, this medication is flexible for a different reason. It's flexible by dose. I one time had a child who was on 15 milligrams of methylphenidate, and he was getting lots of side effects from it. So I reduced him to the next available dose, which was 10 milligrams. And on 10 milligrams, the mother said it was like he was taking no medication at all. It wasn't working. It wasn't doing him any good. He was hyperactive, impulsive, and so on. And I said, well, if we go up to 15, he's going to get side effects. But instead, what I did is started him on the patch, a 15 milligram patch, but I told the mother to cut off a quarter of an inch of the patch. And because the medication is entwined on the patch throughout the entire patch, then that was reducing the dose. So now he was getting about 13.5 milligrams by cutting that quarter inch off. He no longer had the side effects that he was getting on 15 milligrams, and he had the effectiveness that it was producing before without the side effects. But what I had to do was pay attention to the dose that he was getting. And the only way that I could alter that and fine tune it to that degree was either through a patch or through a liquid medication. So if I had needed to, the next step I would have gone to would be a liquid. So having those 46 different medications is beneficial to the pharmaceutical company, But it's also beneficial to me as a physician because it gives me more options in treating the child, and it's beneficial to the child and the adults that use it as well.
Is there one on that list that is what you would consider the most dangerous or the most kind of damaging when it comes to being given to someone who might have ADHD?
No.
There's not one that has a certain side effect that you just don't like or don't agree with?
Well, remember, all of these medications are methylphenidate or amphetamine, with the exception of medications like Strattera, which is considered a non-stimulant. And those medications are used only occasionally for treatment of ADHD. Strattera and other medications like it may take a while to take effect and may produce different side effects. But for the most part, of the 46 medications that I just mentioned, 36 of them are stimulant medications, methylphenidate or amphetamine, exactly the same medications and nothing else. And only the non-stimulants produce new substances, which none of the non-stimulants are as effective as the stimulants, methylphenidate and amphetamine.
Is that because a lot of the root things that you can look at with ADHD happens to do with trying to find some type of stimulation? Like even though when you're a kid, you're putting your fingers in your ears in and out really, really fast because it makes the sound get distorted and it sounds really kind of, I don't know if you've ever done that before. It's a lot of things you'll see. If you stick your, if you take your fingers, I hate to do this to you right now, but take your fingers, go in and out on the little ear parts, not actually inside your ear, on that little lobe that's on the outside.
Yeah.
So like this little piece right here,
right, the pinup,
the little flap, if you just push it in and out, and you push it in and out as I talk and just keep doing it over and over again, it makes the sound go really weird and distorted. And kids do that all the time in cafeterias. You'll see things up on the internet about it. But I used to do it all the time when I was a little kid. And I was stimulating myself. I was doing something that was changing my environment. But that's anything. Energy drinks, caffeine, alcohol, drugs, all these things that can be susceptible where people have addiction issues with ADHD at a higher risk is because they're looking for stimulation. Now, if you use a non-stimulant medication, I don't see that being as effective as the stimulant ones because you're not getting the stimulation aspect. There is still that root thing. It might treat the symptoms.
I mean, what you're saying makes sense, but the fact is that the research shows that the stimulants are far more effective in treating ADHD than the non-stimulants. So the non-stimulants like Strattera and other medications like that are effective for treating ADHD. They're also effective for treating some of the side effects of ADHD. So some types, clonidine is an excellent example. Clonidine is a medication that's effective for treating ADHD, but it primarily works on hyperactivity, not on the attention difficulties. So taking the medication will cause a child to be less hyperactive, and you think it's working really well, but the child isn't paying any better attention than he was before. And you have to be aware of those differences because it looks like the medication's working. But clonidine is an excellent medication for tics, for mood changes, and so on. So if a child gets really moody on a stimulant, then you can combine a stimulant with clonidine, and the clonidine will get rid of the moodiness without making the ADHD worse. As a matter of fact, it will partially treat the ADHD and may allow you to use a lower dose of the stimulant because you're getting benefit from the clonidine. So sometimes we'll use combinations of medications that are effective because one is more effective against the side effects or less likely to cause the side effects. So if a child develops sleep difficulties on one medication, then I might switch them to clonidine because the main side effect of clonidine is sedation.
What about the increments of dosages when it comes to some of these drugs? Why are they always usually pretty high up there? Whether it's a 15 or a 20 or 25, or even, I don't know if it goes up to 100, but it's never something that's low. I think that can kind of scare people a little bit when they get.
Well, you've got to remember that I can't think of a specific example right now, but let's take Ritalin, for instance. Ritalin, take a 5-milligram pill. If you take it three times a day,
15.
Then you'll get 15 milligrams. Instead, you could take Concerta, which comes in a 18 milligram pill. And Concerta is more gradually released over 10 hours. So they get eight, and they don't absorb 3 of the milligrams. So they're really only getting 15 milligrams from Concerta, and they're getting 15 milligrams from the Ritalin. But Ritalin requires 3 doses a day, whereas Concerta requires 1 dose a day. So there's going to be more medication in that pill, 18 milligrams, compared to Ritalin, which only has 5 milligrams, but you have to take 3 of those a day to get the same effect as Concerta, 1 pill, 18 milligrams a day. So again, it's not just a matter of taking one of the medications off the shelf and saying they're all the same. They're not all the same. They are all the same active ingredient, but the way that they are prepared makes a difference, whether it's a liquid, a skin patch, a long-acting, a short-acting pill, a chewable tablet, an orally dissolving tablet so the kids don't have to chew it. There's all these different options. As a matter of fact, if you go to my website, which is ADHDmedicationbook.com, there is a lookup feature where you can specify that you want methylphenidate medications only and the liquid preparations that are available. It'll give you a list of the 2 medications that are liquid methylphenidate medications. So you can go in and alter all the characteristics of the medications and then get a readout of which medications meet those criteria. You want a medication that lasts only 7 or 8 hours, then try this medication. But if you want a Focalin, for instance, but if you want a medication that lasts 16 hours, then you really have to go with the skin patch, because the skin patch is the only medication that will last longer than about 12 hours. There's some newer medications out now, like Procentra and a few others, that are lasting longer, but we haven't had as much experience with some of those because they've only been out in the last year or so.
What would you say would be a large chunk of the problem when it comes to big pharma? Like you mentioned before about all the different types of medications that are just switching over and jacking up their prices or something like that. I mean, there's a big misunderstanding because I think a lot of people, when they hear pill or just any type of drug, they immediately think of the industry and how kind of messed up it is a little bit. And it doesn't necessarily mean the good work of the doctors that are actually trying to help people.
Well, just remember, though, what I described with each of these medications. Each one of them has an advantage and a disadvantage. The disadvantage usually is the cost, but the advantage is in the process of the drug companies trying to make more profits for their shareholders. They've actually helped us and helped the patients as well, inadvertently, because those medications, the longer acting ones, the liquid preparations, the orally dissolving pill, the skin patch, all of those different preparations give the physician more flexibility and the patient more chances of trying a medication that will work for them and work best for them without side effects. If you only have 1 medication to choose from or 2 medications to choose from, well, the task is simple. You either tell the patient it's effective or it's not effective. And for those half of the people that maybe that's not the best medication for them, they're not going to have a treatment. But having these different options for the drug companies, despite the fact that it makes them more money, is a benefit for us and the patient inadvertently. Just remember that you shouldn't have to pay 10 times the amount for the same medication. And so check with the insurance company, because the insurance company will usually, out of those 46 medications, maybe it'll cover 10, but it won't cover all 46. And then you have to pick and choose out of those 10. But knowing what the advantages of they are one over the other will help you by going to your physician and saying, oh, I noticed that my drug company or my insurance company covers Focalin. Could we try that? And knowing that Focalin and Ritalin are the same thing, but there's a big advantage of Focalin, that the way it's prepared reduces the number of side effects. And I won't go into the details of why it was prepared because it's a complex chemical reaction. But in providing that medication, they provided something unique and different, despite the fact that it's really methylphenidate still.
Do you find people can understand more and be open to taking medications when you're able to describe it like how you've described it? Like if people can sit down and talk with you about it, they obviously get a little bit less hesitant about it. I was just playing a lot of devil's advocate because I know the questions that people are probably thinking about when they listen to something like this, but I'm on your side 100%. And like I said, I'm getting prescribed something myself. So it's like, you know, I look at it and I believe every parent has their choice. I know I have a buddy who was medicated through school. He doesn't take it at all now, and he really hates his parents for being put on it. But I don't know if it was because of the fact that he did have to go to the nurse like three times a day to be able to take a pill or something. But I think it's also from a lack of understanding too. There is a lot of stuff out there, whether it's articles or certain people that speak out against stuff. Same thing on the other side. There's a lot of information out there that's put out by people that might not know that much. But if you're just understanding and describing it like how you've done to me today, I feel like a lot of people would be less hesitant.
Well, I appreciate that, but you know, that's why I wrote the book, is that these explanations can't be done in a physician's office in 5 minutes. And you know, most physicians only have about 5 to 10 minutes to see a patient and they move on. I generally took an hour and a half for the first visit and a half hour for every follow-up visit. So it took more time to explain things to the families and let them talk as well and tell me what they're experiencing. The book is different than most books because I introduce every chapter. I don't know if you had a chance to read it,
I did.
but I introduced every chapter with a story. And the stories, I think, are make it a little bit easier to understand the concepts that we're trying to get across than going through a bunch of chemical formulas.
I'd like to say I was that good of a podcast host to be like, why are some of the questions really in your book? It was like, there's a purpose behind that one.
There was what? Say it
There
again?
was a purpose behind that one, why some of the questions were chapters of your book. I know.
Exactly.
Like it's hard for me to read some stuff, but I was looking through that because I was actually interested in looking at the ADHD medication stuff because I do think it there's a lot of stuff that's out there that might be false information, and I'm looking for the correct way to be able to understand it. I thought your book did it pretty well.
Well, pr appreciate that. That was the goal, and I hope it was accomplished.
Did you have a lot of parents that were buying it and giving you feedback on it?
Well, unfortunately, what happened is I'm 73 years old, and so I retired a couple of years ago and wrote the book in my retirement. So I didn't have the book available to me when I was talking to the parents, but I had all those stories built up over 30 years of practice and would generally talk to them about some of those stories. Let me give you another example of why a story is important. I one time I was sitting eating my lunch and I was looking at my schedule for the afternoon and I noticed the name of a girl that I had seen 5 years ago when she was 12 years old. And I thought, what is her name doing on my follow-up list? I haven't seen her for 5 years. So she comes in and she says that she's here by herself. She's without her parents. She's 19 years old now. She was 12 when I initially saw her. And so I said, well, what brings you back? And I said, what's been happening? She said, well, you know, Dr. Karnisky, when you put me on that medication when I was 12 years old, I hated you. And I said, why? And she said, because my friends told me that I wasn't as much fun to be around and they didn't want to spend as much time with me. And I said, why was that? And she said, well, because we used to laugh and joke around and have a really good time and everybody had a great time. But now that I'm on this medication, they say I'm too serious and I take things too seriously. Of course, she took her schoolwork seriously as well. So I said, well, then why are you back today? And she said, well, I'm 19 now. My parents aren't with me. I can make my own decisions now. And I realized that as much as I hated you for prescribing that medication when I was 12, it really helped me in school. And so I'd like to consider going back on the medication just when I'm in school. So we talked about that. I did put her back on medication. She came back in a few weeks later, and I said, how are things going now that you're back on medication? And she said, great. I went from all Fs in my classes to all A's. I'm spending 3 hours a day doing homework instead of 8 hours a day doing homework. And she said, and the world is dramatically different. I said, well, what happened to your friends? Because that was her big concern at 12. Was the, she said, well, that's the weird thing. My friends think I'm a better friend when I'm on my medication. And I said, why is that? And she said, well, because I don't interrupt them. I listen better. I listen to what they're saying. And that's part of what a friendship, a friend is, isn't it? Is listening. But when I was on, when I had ADHD.
Or you're a therapist. Jesus, I'm not sitting there listening to their problems.
I think the point here is that what is the difference between the 12-year-old and the 19-year-old girl that was in my office that day?
Well, a 19-year-old has hindsight and being able to understand what the real long-term things. I mean, honestly speaking.
What happened to the friends? I mean, did it?
Yeah, are those friends going to be there in 20 years? Probably not.
No, but the difference here is that when she was on her medication, they saw her as being a better friend. And so she said, you know, I realize now that the joking around that we did when I was 12 was part of my ADHD, and it was fine then. I enjoyed it. But now I realize, you know, I've got a test coming up tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock. I've got to study till 3 o'clock in the morning for it. I don't have time to joke around. So I think what happens is that she's growing up and she's becoming more mature, but she's recognizing that she had a shortcoming in her attention span and is willing to go back on the medication now. And she was a perfect child for the skin patch. She's in college, by the way, and so at 19. And so she, on Tuesdays and Thursdays, she had a class at 7 in the morning. She had another class at 1 o'clock in the afternoon and another class at 7 p.m. So she would need to keep that patch on for 16 hours. On Wednesdays and Fridays, she only had a morning class and nothing in the afternoon. So she would take her patch off at noon when she was done with her studying. And then she felt more comfortable that way. I didn't necessarily agree with her taking it off, but at least she had the choice.
Yeah.
And she stayed on the medication because she had a choice, because she had a way of tailoring her experience to her needs, to what she saw as her needs. And so when she was 12, she needed friends. When she was 19, she needed focus. And that's the difference.
Yeah. I mean, it's a bigger advocacy for later in life medication, not just early childhood, though.
Exactly.
So, well, I appreciate the time you gave me to talk on my show. Is there a place where people can find your book?
Yes, it's available at Amazon.com. If you could, though, if you're interested in buying it, go to the publisher. The publisher is Roman and Littlefield. So Roman Littlefield. But all you have to really do is type in ADHD medication book.com, all one word.
And I'll make sure I link it in the description so people can be able to click it and check out your website and also your book as well, too. And Walt, again, appreciate the time talking about ADHD with me today. And thanks, everybody, for listening to this episode of Out of the Blank. Stay tuned for our next episode.